journalist, writer, and editor of Multipolarista. Thank you so much. Goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيه ما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. A new report hits out at the U.S. military for its failure to properly address civilian casualties during its operations. Iran calls on the United Nations to take immediate action to halt the massacre of defenseless Yemeni people by the Saudi-led coalition. Also, North Korea confirms its latest test of an upgraded long-range cruise missile and a new missile warhead amid escalating tensions with the United States. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. The U.S. military has been under intense pressure over a drone strike in the Afghan capital last year. Now, a new study says the Pentagon is to blame for, quote, considerable weaknesses and inconsistencies in assessing civilian casualties. The study is conducted by a global policy think tank, the RAND Corporation. It concludes that systematic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were causing it to fall short of its duties in addressing civilian harm. The study also finds that the U.S. military complicates the problem by failing to get adequate information from sources outside the government or armed forces. The August 29 drone attack killed at least 10 civilians, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially claimed that the target was Daesh terrorists, but the Pentagon ultimately called it a tragic mistake following the release of the airstrikes video by Central Command. In order to discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Mike Harris. He is with the veterans today, joining us from Phoenix. Mr. Harris, the report concluded that the Department of Defense is not adequately organized, trained, or equipped to fulfill its current responsibilities for addressing civilian harm. It raises the question, then, as to why the U.S. carried out the airstrike in the first place, killing 10 civilians, including 7 children, and why it claimed to hit, you know, Daesh terrorists.
Well, the U.S. Military, the Department of Defense, has fallen to a level of incompetency, which is beyond imagination. This is due to a multitude of factors, among them the fact that the U.S. military is not doing its constitutionally mandated job of defending the borders. We have open borders in the U.S. that are bringing drugs and illegal aliens into the country, and our military is malapplied overseas fighting wars that have nothing to do with U.S. security. We all know that Afghanistan had nothing to do with 9/11, but yet that was the stated mission, when the real mission in Afghanistan was to secure the opium production and the poppy production, which if you look at how that's impacted the U.S., in the year 2000, there were 5,000 deaths a year due to opium-related deaths, and in the year 2020, that had escalated to over 93,000 deaths per year from opium. So the U.S. has lost its mission. The military has lost its mission. It's being corrupted from the inside out by communist and social justice factions. And quite frankly, the U.S. is incapable of waging a war. And so they take shortcuts. And when shortcuts get taken, they kill civilians. And you know, the mission as stated in Afghanistan was never the true mission. Like I said, Afghanistan had nothing to do with 9/11, but yet that's why they were there. Meanwhile, the opioid problem here in the U.S. and around the world has escalated as a way of funding illicit black programs for the CIA and for other operations. And this is not what the U.S. is based on. This is not what the military's mission is. And this is an utter and complete failure through corruption within the United States military itself.
True. Also, some see Rand lenient towards the Department of Defense and say its findings cannot reflect the real depth of the Department of Defense's weaknesses and inconsistencies. They say what really is causing civilian harm is the U.S. military's mentality towards Iraqi civilians, Afghan civilians. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. You have to look at it. The mission was never to avenge the Taliban. The Taliban is really men of noble character, defending their country against foreign invaders. Like I said, there's no correlation with Afghanistan and 9/11, but that's why we were there. And the real mission, as I said, was to cultivate the opium trade. So when you have corruption at that level, civilian casualties become a minor issue to protecting the profits that certain parties are making over this drug trade. And that just tells you how deeply corrupted the U.S. as a whole has become, and the military in particular, corrupted and incompetent, to where they're making business decisions based on the drug trafficking, and they're not there for the mission of fighting a war, an unjustified war that the U.S. has no business being in the first place. This is really a failure of our intelligence agencies and a failure of our military and an abject policy failure on behalf of the USA. This is really, this is inexcusable. And the day of reckoning is coming for the parties within the U.S. who are responsible for all of this mess. The day of reckoning is very soon.
And another thing that I want to discuss with you is that U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has issued a directive ordering the United States military to do more to protect civilians from harm in drone attacks and other combat operations. And basically what Austin is saying is that, I know we killed civilians, I know we killed children, but we try to do more to protect civilians from harm in the future. What about the civilians who have lost their lives, their families? Why there is no mention of them in his statement? And why the U.S. is not held to account?
Well, Lloyd Austin is an incompetent affirmative action hire who doesn't deserve the position he's in. As I stated, the U.S. military is busy on a social justice crusade here, trying to rectify the alleged sins of the past due to slavery and other things that go back hundreds of years that no one alive today had anything to do with. But they're masking all of this. They're masking this incompetence. They put a guy like Lloyd Austin there to take the heat, to make it look like we're a diverse and inclusive society. And it's really a fraud. The whole thing is a fraud. The damage to civilians, number one, the U.S. had no business in Iraq or Afghanistan. And the fact that civilians are dying, it doesn't matter, because the whole thing is based on a lie. And that is the lie of 9/11, why the U.S. was in both of those countries anyway. It's a complete fraud upon the American people and the people of the world. And I will say again that the American people have been victims as much as anyone in Iraq or anyone in Afghanistan, because we've lost 93,000 people in the year of 2020. like I said, the opioid deaths in this country went from 5,000 a year in the year 2000 before 9/11 up to 93,000 a year. This is a war on the American people. This is a genocide against our own people that is being enabled by the Pentagon and the CIA to allow the importation of opioids and other drugs into the U.S. Mm-hmm. This is a much more complex issue here, and quite frankly, drug dealers don't care if civilians get killed. They just want their profit. They're trying to cover their tracks right now so they're not scrutinized too heavily and that their crimes are not revealed. But that's really what's going on. This is the issue here that we in the U.S. have to address within our own government. And as I said, the day of reckoning is very close for these people who've been doing these very, very terrible things to both the U.S. population as well as the populations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And our apologies, the American people are good people. We've just been infiltrated by certain Zionist elements that have been really degrading our military and our entire government. Our Department of Justice is compromised. Our judicial system is compromised. The FBI is compromised. There's not a government agency out there. They have all turned toxic and become enemies of the American people and consequently enemies of the people of the world as well. And it's time for justice to be served.
Thank you so much, Mike Harris, for joining us and for your contribution. That was Mike Harris, an editor with The Veterans Today, joining us from Phoenix. Iran calls on the United Nations to take immediate measures to halt the massacre of defenseless Yemenis by the Saudi-led coalition. In a letter to the United Nations representative for Yemen, a senior advisor to Iran's foreign minister says Tehran condemns bombings of cities, civilian buildings, and infrastructure of Yemen. Ali Asghar Khawaji says the Saudi-led coalition's atrocities run counter to international laws. He says the Yemen's crisis has no military solution. The Iranian diplomat also calls for the lifting of a Saudi-led or Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen that has exacerbated the country's humanitarian crisis. The Saudi-led coalition has carried out dozens of deadly airstrikes on Yemen this week. In one such attack, more than 90 people were killed when the coalition's warplanes bombed a prison in Yemen.
Yemen continues to reel from a Saudi attack on a prison facility in Sa'dah province, with the number of fatalities continuing to rise. The airstrike that took place early on Friday left hundreds of people dead and wounded. Mohammed Al-Khulaidi was one of the victims. He describes how he was injured.
The missile hit ward number 3, and I was in ward number 2. My mates and I were sitting and chatting about our release from prison and how our cases will stand with a judge, and what would happen after we are released. Then the plane struck at around 1:30 or 2 a.m. Suddenly, piles of debris were on top of me.
Yemenis say there was no military target nearby the prison and the attack was unjustified.
There were only inmates in the facility. There were no forces to be targeted. Even their red and pickup trucks. Why did they strike? I don't know why they hit us.
Yemeni officials are calling for an international investigation into the latest Saudi bloodshed.
We denounce this act against those prisoners who were killed unjustly by aggressors. Some of the victims are children. The Saudi-led coalition has crossed all red lines. We call on the international community and human rights organizations to stop the Saudi aggression, condemn this attack, and bring its perpetrators to justice.
The air raid drew widespread condemnation, including from the UN, which also called for a transparent probe.
The Secretary General condemns the airstrikes launched by the Saudi-led coalition against a detention center in Sa'dah. The attacks directed against civilians and civilian infrastructures are prohibited by international humanitarian law. The UN calls for prompt, effective, and transparent investigations into the attack.
Iran has also condemned the attack, calling on the UN to hold the perpetrators of the crime to account. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Since then, hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives. Despite relentless Saudi bombardments of the impoverished country, the Yemeni armed forces and allied Ansarullah fighters have gradually grown stronger, leaving Riyadh and its allies, most notably the UAE, bogged down in the country. They have repeatedly conducted retaliatory attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia. A turning point in the conflict came last week when the Yemeni army opened a new retaliatory front targeting the UAE capital, Abu Dhabi, and its commercial hub, Dubai, with drones and ballistic missiles. The army called the attacks a warning to Emiratis to change their stance and keep away from Saudis. Despite the enormous loss of lives and destruction of vital infrastructure in Yemen, the UN has done nothing to stop the mayhem and has only released a few statements once in a while. This as Riyadh continues to receive arms from its Western backers, most notably the United States and Britain. With no end in sight, the situation seems to be bleak for the Yemeni people unless a collective international effort is made to stop the aggression.
North Korea confirms its latest missile launches amid growing tensions with the United States over the country's nuclear weapons program. State media KCNA said one of the tests was an operated long-range cruise missile and the other was a warhead of a tactical guided missile. On Wednesday, the South Korean military said it detected the launch of two short-range ballistic missiles. The launches drew condemnation from the United States. North Korea has recently said it will bolster its defenses against the United States and consider resuming all temporarily suspended activities.
For the sixth time in January, North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to try to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized, and leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea.
South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th, with North Korea conducting six rounds of missile tests in just the past month. Security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
South Korea's COVID cases keep surging, with the country logging yet another record in its daily infections. South Korea posted more than 16,000 new infections for Thursday. That's the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. Daily COVID infections hit record highs on Wednesday and Tuesday, too. They have been rising steadily in the past 2 weeks because of the Omicron variant that's highly contagious. Health authorities in South Korea are now warning that daily case loads could surge to five-digit figures in the coming weeks if the current pace of the Omicron spread continues. The government has extended restrictions on businesses to contain the virus. Venezuela's National Electoral Commission has rejected a request for a referendum on President Nicolas Maduro, citing lack of signatures for a recall vote. The commission gave Maduro's opponents 12 hours on Wednesday to collect a minimum of 4.2 million signatures from the country's eligible voters. But their efforts could receive only 1% of the country's 21 million strong voter registry. On Thursday, the council announced that Maduro's opponents failed to collect enough signatures to proceed with a referendum on the presidency. Venezuela's constitution allows officials who have completed at least half of their term to be removed from office by a vote. And that's your world news for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
USAID's unpreparedness following the withdrawal reflects long-standing structural issues within the agency and is in line with the chaos that plagued various divisions of the U.S. government, starting with the State Department, to which USAID's work is subordinated, says Alice Sperry, journalist, in an article titled USAID Contractors Denounce Agency's Betrayal of Thousands of Afghans Who Carried Out Its Mission. Stay tuned for more. Last October, the top official at the United States Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, got a call with the agency's contractors in Afghanistan. After the last U.S. troops had left the country following a chaotic and deadly evacuation, USAID encouraged its partners to use remaining program funds to ensure the safety of their staff, including by covering living and evacuation costs. Days later, the agency issued a stop work order instructing contractors to cease all non-humanitarian operations in Afghanistan except for those concerning safety and security, according to an internal memo. "Now Power offered thanks for everyone's hard work. We value you," she told contractors, according to multiple people who were on the call. The contractors, many of whom were still scrambling to help their Afghan colleagues leave the country, had been hoping for more specific guidance. They said they had submitted questions to the agency before the call, asking for instructions on how to pay staff at a time when the country's banking system had collapsed. USAID had prohibited contractors from using informal money transfer systems known as hawalas. It took two more months for the agency to authorize them on a case-by-case basis. In December, the agency also authorized the use of foreign currency to pay Afghan staff, a reversal from earlier guidelines. On the call, contractors flooded Power with different versions of the same questions. "She had zero answers," said one, who, like all other contractors interviewed for this article, asked not to be named to discuss internal conversations. "She looked like a deer caught in the headlights. She had no idea what was happening on the ground." Another participant told Intercept, "We were blindsided by how much the senior level of USAID was unaware of what was going on with tens of thousands of its employees. Many development professionals had welcomed Power's arrival at an agency that they felt was in dire need of reform." A former journalist and United Nations ambassador, she is the highest profile official to ever lead the agency and the first to also sit on the National Security Council. But her failure to answer the contractors' questions was just another disappointment to those who had hoped her background would boost the agency's influence on foreign policy. During the turbulent U.S. withdrawal last August, Power had been uncharacteristically silent. As Politico noted in a profile last fall, she didn't even tweet about it. USAID's unpreparedness following the withdrawal, however, runs much deeper than the person at the helm. It reflects long-standing structural issues within the agency and is in line with the chaos that plagued various divisions of the U.S. government, starting with the State Department, to which USAID's work is subordinated. Unlike the Secretaries of State and Defense, the USAID Administrator is not a cabinet-level position, and development work has long been treated as a tool of diplomacy, serving rather than shaping political priorities. Bill O'Keefe, an Executive Vice President at Catholic Relief Services, a USAID partner, told Intercept, "USAID is a Lilliputian with a bunch of Gullivers running around." For two decades, the agency has been the face of the U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. To tens of thousands of Afghans employed on USAID projects, it was the agency they had believed in and worked for, often at enormous personal risk, that ultimately betrayed them. Many of the failures that characterized USAID's handling of the withdrawal were consistent with issues that had defined its work in Afghanistan for years. USAID contractors described the agency as an unwieldy apparatus run by bureaucrats who are divorced from the reality on the ground. USAID's staff mostly operates from Washington or from inside the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. The work is outsourced to contractors, who go into the field and hire their own local staff, and is debilitated by unrealistic timelines and wasteful spending imposed by legislators looking to tout quick successes hardly a sustainable model for development. USAID's Afghan workers were not on calls with power and other agency officials last fall, so it was the contractors who had to report back to them and field countless messages and requests from help from people the agency had effectively abandoned. USAID put everything on us, one contractor said. In emails and recorded calls shared with Intercept, Afghans who worked on USAID projects talked with growing desperation about not having the money to feed their families and about their fears of being targeted for having worked with the U.S. government. In awkward and at times testy exchanges, the contractors, the effective intermediaries between the agency and its workforce, could offer only apologies. One told Afghan staff over and over on one call last fall, "We still don't have any guidance. We have been asking these questions since August. I am just sorry." What can I say to them? That contractor later told Intercept, adding, "We have failed you in every single way." Late last November, USAID informed contractors, many of whom were still struggling to get clarity on logistical questions about payments and evacuations, that they would no longer be allowed to use remaining project funds to help their staff. In a memo first made public by Politico, agency officials cited the continued fluidity of the situation in Afghanistan but gave no further explanation for the sudden reversal. The funds, which had already been allocated to USAID projects meant to run through next spring, were a drop in the bucket for USAID, the contractor said. USAID did not answer questions about how much money was left over, but a contractor estimated it to be in the tens of millions out of an agency budget of $41 billion in 2021. The money that wasn't spent was returned to USAID.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
More than 100 raids on different governorates of Yemen were carried out by the Saudi coalition forces within 24 hours last week between Wednesday and Friday, causing the death of dozens, wounding hundreds, and causing severe damage to entire neighborhoods. The insane raids targeted homes and civilian facilities in Saada, Hudaydah, Ma'rib, and Sana'a, and cut off the internet from a country of 30 million humans after destroying Yemen's only internet provider located in Hudaydah. All that while the world has exchanged blood for oil. A world where Yemeni human life is worthless. A world that handed over the hammer of justice to the arrogant vile of the earth, who are called the owners of majesties, eminences, and sovereignty. Thus was the day when the UN Security Council condemned the Yemeni rightful retaliation to the UAE-Saudi aggression by targeting the oil reservoir in Abu Dhabi, while hundreds of martyrs and wounded innocent civilians never even moved that council. Massacres against humanity committed by the US-led Saudi-Emirati aggression on Yemen From Sada to Hodeida and Sana'a, ambulance crews were unable to rescue those trapped under the rubble. While nearly 100 martyrs and hundreds of wounded have been counted so far, including at least 30 children. What added soul to the injury of the Yemenis was that the massacres of last week did not find a place on the agendas of the officials, especially the Arab ones, as well as the governments of the world and those who never miss a chance to scream about freedoms and human rights everywhere. With all the scenes of destruction now taking place on the heads of children in Yemen, in Sada, Hodeida, and Sana'a, is it enough to describe the war as absurd? It's a pointless war, without results, and it will never reach its declared or hidden goals. Don't get me wrong, this is not an emotional statement. Saudi Arabia has spent on its war against Yemen more than $412 billion over 5 years from 2015 to 2020, and did not achieve the results that it announced its ability to achieve within weeks, according to its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. The United Arab Emirates followed the same path when it entered the war and allocated nearly 20% of its government spending to military expenditures, and the result was nothing but a state of constant worry that spread among those investing in its cities. So yes, this US-led Saudi-Emirati war against all of Yemen is least to say absurd, because its perpetrators insist on repeating the same actions using the same means while hoping for different results. That is not only absurd, that's crazy. Yet what could absurdity mean for the victims, the martyrs, and the bereaved who lost their homes and loved ones and suffered through waves of ancient diseases due to an inhumane blockade? Yemenis are not numbers and statistics of missing victims and martyrs. It is not a cover photo depicting shattered buildings and torn streets. Yemen is us. We are Yemen. Our blood is one, our destiny is one, our enemy is one. Our victory is coming, God willing. Welcome to the news screen. I'm Marwa Osman. Details continue to unfold about the Emirati-Saudi bloodbath in retaliation to Ansarullah's Yemen cyclone operation. The U.S.-led Emirati-Saudi aggression targeted civilian objects in the capital Sana'a in violent attacks that appeared to be similar to the serial attacks that the city was previously subjected to during the first days of the war in late March of 2015. Now, air raids hit various neighborhoods of the capital Sana'a, where a population exceeds 4 million humans, with F-16 and F-15 war jets. More than 100 were martyred and more than 120 wounded as a result of the raids of the Saudi coalition on a central prison in Sada. Further west in Hodeida, 6 martyrs, including 3 children and 18 wounded, most of whom are children, is the latest toll of the coalition's crime in Al-Muasalat neighborhood. All that in complete internet outage in Yemen after the aggression targeted the international telecommunication and internet gateway in Hodeida, which is Yemen's only internet provider. To discuss this issue and much more with us from London is Ms. Isra Al-Frask, human rights advocate. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Isra. Now, a genocide in Yemen during the past week, with scores martyred in Sana'a, Sada, and Hodeida under constant hysterical bombing by the U.S. Saudi Emirati-led aggression on the country, resulting in more than an addition of 150 deaths up until now. We don't know if there's more people under the rubble, including at least 30 children. Will such war crimes at least deter Ansarullah from returning fire back at any state that is aggressive towards Yemen, that is actually wreaking havoc inside of Yemen? We did see that they retaliated with a second cyclone, but would that be it, or will they continue?
Of course, the response has been settled with the second Yemen hurricane operation. We saw it on the news that was coming out of the UAE capital and the Saudi cities, starting with a response to the massacres that were committed in Sana'a, Hodeida, and Sada. However, the statements of officials and leaders within Ansarullah say that the Yemeni response will not stop at this point, and that the escalation described by the forces of the coalition of aggression is basically a Yemeni response to the aggression itself. Every day, the Yemeni armed forces confirmed that the range of response is open as long as the aggression continues, and this was confirmed in the last statement issued on Monday by Brigadier General Yahya al-Sariyeh, spokesman of the Yemeni armed forces. He clearly said that the response to the Emiratis will not stop here, rather it is only the beginning of the response. This was clarified by the recent statement of the Ansarullah Political Council. Therefore, what necessitated this response was the massacres perpetrated by the aggression. As long as this aggression continues, the pretext of Ansarullah's right for self-defense continues, and the utilization of this resistance continues.
But Ms. Isra, massacre after the other is committed in Yemen against the Yemeni people, especially the last one, which is they are now out of reach with the world. They are out of touch with the world because of the complete internet outage, because Saudi jets went along and bombed Yemen's only internet service provider in Hudaydah, and it's the International Telecommunications and Internet Gateway. That is for sure another kind of war crime, because they're trying to kill people without allowing the media to see it. But the United Nations Security Council is silent again. I mean, they might issue some sort of a statement saying, okay, we don't like people being killed, but this is a holocaust, for the love of God. Why is Yemen not even on the map for these people?
I'm totally correct. Yemen is not on the map of the United Nations, nor on the political map of the Security Council, and this is not surprising at all. It is certainly painful, because victimization is difficult, but it's not surprising. Well, let's look at the different nations in this world. Does the UN Security Council represent all these peoples, especially the people of West Asia? Definitely not. Or even all the peoples of the world? No. It doesn't represent them. It is a council for managing political deals for major countries, especially the United States of America. This council is the same council that legitimizes wars under the pretext of maintaining global peace and security, and finds legal solutions and reprehensible justifications to give a green light to perpetuate more massacres in this region. And this is the same Security Council that does not see the Iranian people, who have been subjected to sanctions for more than four decades because of the political choices of this people. This is the same council also that could not prevent the United States from invading Iraq in 2003. And it is the same Security Council that offered the Palestinians nothing but expressions of concern in equating the victim with the perpetrator. It is the Security Council itself which does not see the people of Latin America or hear about the famines and crimes that are being committed in African countries. This is the Security Council. The process of international solidarity, which takes place sometimes in the name of democracy and other times in the name of human rights, has yielded nothing. The Security Council was not able to liberate Gaza. The resistance did so, just as the case in the south of Lebanon. It was the resistance that actually regained the land and defeated the occupation.
And it seems the same thing is happening in Yemen, Israel, because the Yemeni armed forces responded to the massacres committed by the forces of aggression with a second hurricane of Yemen against both the United Arab Emirates and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We did see that a plunge in stock markets in the Persian Gulf Arab states was happening this morning, or the morning of Monday. The response was quick after the threats of Brigadier General Yahya al-Sariyeh, who advised foreign companies to actually leave Emirates because he says it is not safe. Do you think that this response will compel them, force the aggression to come and sit on the table of dialogue, or maybe we will see an unleash of madness of the Saudi Emirati war machine?
Dear Marwa, if you would allow me, I have to distinguish between the Saudi position in this particular section and the UAE position. Will this retaliation drag the two sides to the negotiation table? Well, certainly the two sides need to find a political way out of the Yemeni quagmire. But we need to understand a very important matter. Before the Yemeni response and basically the explicit promise of Brigadier General Yahya al-Sariyeh, the channels of communication between the Emiratis and the decision-making capitals, who are allies of Ansarullah, did not stop. Tahnoun bin Zayed contacted Tehran, Baghdad, and even the Syrian capital, Damascus. Also, the Lebanese newspaper, Al-Akhbar, reported that there are channels of communication with Hezbollah in Lebanon. All of these channels were needed by the children of Zayed in order to be used to prevent this Yemeni retaliation, which we all witnessed at dawn on Monday. Nevertheless, there are Emirati positions that we hear and are being transmitted that the Emiratis basically did not commit the recent massacres and that the Americans and Saudis committed them, and that they were the ones who actually even pushed the Emirati giant brigade in Shabwa. If there was an Emirati disavowal of the massacres before the second Yemeni response, let alone after the operation and after seeing how this response impacted UAE's economy. This country cannot withstand even a third Yemeni response. It is a country that is affected by a tweet and by breaking news. We all saw a simple tweet by the director of the office of the Yemeni presidency, Mr. Ahmed Hamid, who asked a single question. What do you know about Burj Khalifa? In a matter of minutes, we saw how the world was shaken and began wailing about it.
Well, it seems to be that the upcoming couple of days will be decisive for an entire nation in the United Arab Emirates only because of a couple of ballistic missiles from the resistance in Yemen. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Well, thank you very much from London, Ms. Isra Al-Fas, human rights advocate, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned because next we will be talking about Turkey trying to get closer to the Israeli entity.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
While responding to questions about changes in diplomatic relations with Israel, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that his office was having talks with Isaac Herzog, the occupation's president, and that he may be visiting Turkey soon. Emphasizing similar willingness on the Israeli side for fully normalizing bilateral relations, Erdogan said that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett also has a positive approach. Now, look no further than the strong alliance forged in recent years between the Israeli entity, Greece, and Cyprus, especially in the domains of security and energy, to understand Turkey's interest in summing out on Palestine once and for all. The Israeli occupation has clarified lately that any rapprochement with Turkey will not come at the expense of its strong ties with Cyprus and Greece. Turkey seeks closer ties with the Israeli entity in this following report.
After Al Monitor revealed earlier a report about secret talks between Turkey and Israel, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced the possibility of a visit by the Israeli president to Turkey. As part of propaganda about the visit, Turkey announced it unilaterally via the far-right pro-government media outlet Daily Sabah. That article was then recycled by reports in Israeli media about Turkish President Erdogan claiming the visit would happen. Erdogan even said during a press conference with his Serbian counterpart Aleksandar Vučić in the Turkish capital Ankara last week that there are talks with the Israeli president and it is possible that he will have a visit to Turkey. On the possibility of cooperation with Israel in the Eastern Mediterranean, Erdogan said they aim to make progress through positive approaches. The Turkish president then stressed that Ankara will do everything it can if this matter is based on mutual profit. The very next day, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu spoke with Israel's Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. Reports claimed it was the first call at the ministerial level in 13 years. Meanwhile, Ankara wants Tel Aviv to know that it is celebrating the decision by the U.S. to no longer support an Israel-Greece gas pipeline. The message is that Palestine's stolen natural gas by Israel now has nowhere to go and will have to go through Turkey. This is not the first time Ankara floated this idea of ties with Israel. It has done so several times over the past years, almost always timed to prevent Israel-Greece-Cyprus natural gas deals. Back in 2019 and early 2020, Turkey floated ideas about reconciliation when Israel and Greece were showing growing ties. It didn't want the East Med gas pipeline to come into fruition. It also sought to reach out to Israel when it was clear that Egypt, the UAE, France, Cyprus, and Greece were going to sign off on a declaration expressing concerns about Ankara's threats in the Eastern Mediterranean. In May 2020, Turkey again said it would reconcile with Israel. It even fed media entirely unsubstantiated stories about how Ankara had clashed with Hezbollah in Syria and that Israel might share common views there about Iran's role. The obvious goal for Turkey is for Israeli gas to flow through Turkey. However, when talking about Turkish-Israeli relations, the economic, commercial, and tourism aspects cannot be overlooked. And the role of each of them in strengthening those relations, especially when it comes to major global projects related to the field of energy, despite the fact that it is stolen Palestinian energy. In addition, cooperation in the security and military fields is considered a mainstay in the relations between the two parties. This begs the question of Turkey's real intentions towards Palestine rather than towards the Israeli occupation, given that no evidence is needed to spot the interest in the latter rather than the former.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Aleppo is Sarkis Kasarjian, journalist expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Sarkis. Now, the Israeli media confirmed Isaac Herzog's visit to Turkey and said that the latter, whom Erdogan had called twice before now, had received an official invitation from Turkey and would soon respond to that invitation. How is it that how is it going to be beneficial in any way towards Turkey? I mean, when Israel has indeed announced that any rapprochement with Turkey will not affect its ties with Cyprus and Greece.
Well, Israel did issue a statement regarding its relations with Cyprus and Greece and their inability to be affected by the entity's relations with Turkey, especially that the Israeli-Greek relations are new ones that have only developed in the past decade, part of which in a reaction to the bad relationship between Tel Aviv and Ankara. But in my view, the relationship between Turkey and Israel will in fact affect the latter's relations with Cyprus and Greece due to the historical tension between Turkey and Greece, which has recently escalated. But I think that the European Union on the one hand and Tel Aviv on the other are counting on the possibility of changing the Turkish approach towards the Greek hotspot. And this, of course, depends on the extent of European pressures that can be activated against Turkey to compel it to behave more moderately or more in line with good neighborly relations with Greece. I believe the Turkish-Israeli relations are the result of serious shifts in the developments of the region. First, in terms of a change in the Turkish foreign policy on the one hand, and secondly, I think that the American rejection of the project to transport gas from Israel via pipelines to Cyprus and Greece, which completely ignored Turkey, also affected the acceleration of seeking better ties between Israel and Turkey. And thirdly, I think that the excellent relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates on the one hand and the Turkish-Emirati normalization on the other hand contributed to the development of Turkish-Israeli relations. It's important to note that, despite the tension between the two parties that prevailed during the past decade, trade between Turkey and Israel, tourist trips and military agreements remained active at the highest levels.
Mr. Sarkis, but some explain this rapprochement as a sudden development in the Turkish position towards the Israeli entity. But if we actually go back to the pages of history after the establishment of the Zionist entity in the Arab Muslim land of Palestine, we see that Turkey is the first Islamic country to recognize this entity in March of 1949, 10 months after its emergence in Palestine. And since that date, it has not hesitated to conclude military and political agreements. So what's new with these relations then?
It's true, as you mentioned, that Turkey was the first country to recognize the establishment of the Israeli entity. It was the first Islamic and regional country to do so. What's new in the relationship is a change in the tone of the Turkish discourse. I mean, during the last decade, Turkey built its policy on the neo-Ottoman rhetoric. This rhetoric, of course, obliges Ankara to take formal anti-Israel positions. As I mentioned earlier, trade remained as is between them. Commercial relations between the two parties remained unchanged, and even transit and military agreements also remained unchanged. What changed was only the rhetoric and diplomatic representations, and this is due to the necessity of Turkish foreign policy back then. Today, Turkey has modified this discourse due to the pressing economic conditions at home and as a part of the new policy announced by Erdogan, which is the policy of liquidating problems with neighboring countries and with regional powers. So that's just what has changed. Even during the years of tension between the two sides, Israeli pilots were training in Turkish airspace. Even the pride of the Turkish industry, and I mean here the war spy drones, are originally an Israeli-made technology, and their manufacturing was a joint project between Ankara and Tel Aviv.
Well, but we still see, Mr. Sakis, that Turkey keeps utilizing its media propaganda machine to insinuate that any update ties with Israel will not affect its support to Palestine and the Palestinian resistance, especially in Gaza. Mind you, Turkey was not even able to break the sea blockade against Gaza in 2009 with a peaceful flotilla. Then why not just tell the truth like other Persian Gulf Arab states who openly say that the Palestinian cause is no longer any interest for them? So why doesn't Turkey say it?
Well, that is because Turkey's policy is based on this particular issue. Turkey does not want to lose the Palestinian card that it constantly uses to put pressure on Tel Aviv and on other countries in the region. Erdogan in particular built his policy on a set of issues or files. One of the most important files is the Palestinian one. Turkey cannot continue its Islamic policy between two brackets without the existence of the Palestinian cause in its speech. Therefore, Turkey is compelled to talk about this issue. But on the ground, realistically, since the events of 2009, the Davos conference, and the Mavi Marmara flotilla, Turkey has not submitted anything new regarding Palestine. The Turkish discourse, especially towards the internal public opinion, and in particular, the discourse of the Justice and Development Party, and even the popular base of this party, which consists of conservatives, is forced not to abandon the issue of Palestine in the media, or else it will lose a lot of popularity at home, and this will of course affect the results of the upcoming elections in 2023. Therefore, I think that will not change its discourse in the media, but on the ground, there is nothing new.
Well, we will see what will happen after the Isaac Herzog visit to Turkey. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Sakis Kasarjian, journalist, expert in Turkish affairs, for joining us from Aleppo to discuss this issue. Thank you very much for your contribution. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Salam.
In the limelight.
The British government's third five-yearly assessment of the risk from climate change was published on Monday, 24th of January. While taking what many regarded as a conservative estimate of future risks, the assessment painted a future of drastic disruption and costly impacts from the climate crisis. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Fiona Harvey and Niels de Hoog. The piece is titled Climate Crisis Could Wipe 1% a Year Off UK Economy by 2045, Threatens Future of Winter Olympics. The British government has said the climate crisis will wipe at least 1% a year off Britain's economy by 2045. If global temperatures are allowed to rise by 2 degrees Celsius. Minister said more action would be needed on key areas such as flood defenses, restoring natural protections such as peatlands and wetlands, and making the built environment more resilient to extreme weather events. The government's third five-year assessment of the risks from climate change was published on Monday, 24th of January. While taking what many regarded as a conservative estimate of future risks, the assessment painted a future of drastic disruption and costly impacts from the climate crisis. Damage to Britain's food production and to infrastructure from extreme weather and the risks of flooding are all likely to cost more than £1 billion a year each. In all, at least eight areas of risk were judged likely to cost more than £1 billion a year by 2050. However, some may cost much more, as the risks were assessed in bands, with more than £1 billion the highest available. Many other potential areas of risk, such as risks to business supply chains and the delivery of health services, and the potential damage to culturally important heritage sites, were judged unable to be fully assessed. Joe Churchill, the Minister for Climate Adaptation, said, "The scale and severity of the challenge posed by climate change means we cannot tackle it overnight, and although we've made good progress in recent years, there is clearly much more that we need to do. By recognizing the further progress that needs to be made, we're committing to significantly increasing our efforts and setting a path towards the third National Adaptation Program, which will set ambitious and robust policies to make sure we are resilient to climate change